morning to the book of Nehemiah, Nehemiah chapter 5. It is all part of our culture and our time. We all are very results-oriented. And that can filter over into the spiritual realm as well, and I don't know that it's always a healthy thing. It depends on what we think the results are that we are striving for. And sometimes what we imagine in our minds is the end game, if you will, may not at all be the ultimate purpose for which we should be, or in which we should be pursuing God. But we tend to be very results oriented. Parents have been known to emotionally and psychologically just beat themselves up, because of course our goal is for our children to serve the Lord. But then there is that thing known as free will, and that can be pretty difficult when our children go another direction. And then we go off into these discussions about the fact that anytime a child goes the wrong direction, apparently there's something defective in those parents. Well, there may have been some fault on the part of parents, but there may not have been. We all have faults as parents. I've known some parents who've been very negligent toward their children, and their children have gone the wrong direction. I have also known some parents, however, that I think were very faithful to the Lord, and they did all that they could do. And their children made a wrong decision. I know shepherds who beat themselves up pretty hard sometimes, and I don't know that it's warranted, that have done all that they can do to shepherd the flock, and there have been many people that have received the benefit of them understanding that this flock is not their flock, it's God's flock, and yet maybe there were some others who rejected their counsel. It's not always the fault of the shepherds. We can apply that to gospel preachers, all of us as Christians. We get very results-oriented. And I'm not saying those aren't good objectives, but I'm saying the ultimate objective is to serve God and be faithful and let Him, in His goodness and His grace, reward us as He sees fit. We find within, I think, the prayers of the book of Nehemiah, perhaps a different way, though, to evaluate things. In the end, Nehemiah's success may be evaluated, not necessarily just on the basis of walls that were built or laws that were enforced, although there were plenty of achievements in the work of Nehemiah by God's grace. But what was the ultimate objective? What's the ultimate objective for every parent? What is the ultimate objective for every gospel preacher or every shepherd, every child of God? It is to be faithful to the Lord. And there may be some visible results that we see, and there may not be some visible results that we see. But my ultimate objective as a parent, as a servant of God, as a gospel preacher, must be to be faithful to the Lord. And when I think about, and when we think about Nehemiah, God did not weigh Nehemiah's efforts by how much or how little he accomplished, but in light of his faithfulness. The objective was to be faithful to God. What mattered was his character and his relationship with his God. And the same is true of us. And when we are faithful to God, God in His truth and His word and His grace can work through us to accomplish what He wishes. Let's talk a little bit about the background of Nehemiah, just to get some feel for who he was. As a man, Nehemiah was a Jew who was born into captivity, who by God's providence rose to a place of prominent leadership. In Persia, he was the king's cupbearer, which of course was a position of trust and access to the king. In Jerusalem, he became governor and he oversaw the rebuilding of the walls and the city. His work seems to have overlapped the work of men like Ezra and Haggai and Zechariah. It was a time of great messianic significance. You'll find in the book of Zechariah, the rebuilding of the temple was critical in the timeline for the messianic realization, the Messiah coming. And even though that would be much later, the temple was to be rebuilt. Nehemiah later on would come along and have the task of rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem, which were lying in waste. We see some of these allusions in Daniel 9 as well as Isaiah chapter 44 through chapter 45. But Nehemiah was a man of great faith in a very difficult time. He had an intense concern for his people. So we have some idea of the character of Nehemiah, that he wanted to be faithful to God and did not allow the discouragement of those who tried to oppress him. As many times we have seen in Nehemiah chapter 2 and so on, he was going to be faithful to his covenant with his God. Shortly after the beginning of the captivity, Nebuchadnezzar had ransacked the temple. He had emptied the treasury. He had broken down the walls of the city. He had burned so much. And nearly 100 years later, the temple had been rebuilt, but the city was essentially uninhabited. Throughout the days of Nehemiah, we see rebuilding and reform. And often when we think of Nehemiah, those are the concepts that come to our mind, this notion of rebuilding. When we think about the cry of Nehemiah, despite Nehemiah's faithful service, he constantly is dealing with pressure both within and from without. The enemies of God were even among some of those who profess to be God's people. And it's interesting, and this is what I really want to focus on with you. There are a few times in which we see this prayer of Nehemiah. And I don't know that I'd always noticed it before, the way he articulates and the way he expresses this prayer. And it's not just one time. And what we want to do is look at this particular prayer and then look at the context behind it and draw some application this morning. But with all of these challenges, Nehemiah's response, with all the adversity, with the task in front of him, is this. He says, "Remember me, O my God, for good." And you may think, well, did he think that somehow God had forgotten him? I don't think so. So what is behind this idea of praying to God to remember me? And who is it that can pray that prayer? Who is it that can, in humility, reach out to God with this cry, this supplication, "Remember me, O God, for the good that I have done"? Certainly the impenitent can't pray that prayer and be genuine. The unfaithful cannot pray that prayer. This is not an arrogant prayer or a boastful prayer. This is Nehemiah, who had so given his heart and his mind and his soul to God and his work. And I believe with a contrite heart and a dependent heart, yet he is saying, "I have given my all to you, God. Please remember me." So the question for us is, how did Nehemiah live in a way in which he could confidently ask God to remember his loyalty, his faithfulness, his good deeds? As a man of prayer, Nehemiah committed to God what he had so faithfully done. The Hebrew word hesed here is usually used of God. God's faithfulness to his covenant with his people. And yet Nehemiah is saying, "I'm giving my heart and my mind to being faithful to my covenant with God. Whatever happens, whatever adversity I have, I want to be faithful to my God. I want to walk in His image." As we look at Nehemiah chapter 5, one of the first times we see this prayer in Nehemiah, one of the earlier times, in the text, Nehemiah 5. And I would submit to you this morning that to pray this prayer, this prayer comes from someone who was offering a life of sacrifice. Someone who's not sacrificial, someone who is selfish and self-absorbed can't pray this prayer. And so when we look at Nehemiah chapter 5, and we're going to look at this context, but let's begin by just looking at verse 19 toward the end of the section we're noting. We see Nehemiah praying, "Remember me, O my God, for good, according to all that I've done for this people." But when we go back to this context, and we're going to try to develop this a little bit, we see that there was a threat from within. There was a threat from within, surprisingly, God's own people. You know, it's one thing when your enemies are coming from without. It's one thing when you have those who are mocking and condescending toward them that are without the community, but when you have people in the community that are attacking, that can be quite distressing. In chapter 5, and let's begin in verses 1, reading down through verse 11, we see this threat from within. "Now there was a great outcry of the people and of their wives against their Jewish brothers. For there were those who said, 'We, our sons and our daughters are many, therefore let us get grain that we may eat and live.' There were others who said, 'We are mortgaging our fields, our vineyards, and our houses that we might get grain because of the famine. Also, there were those who said, 'We have borrowed money for the king's tax on our fields and our vineyards. Now our flesh is like the flesh of our brothers, our children like their children. Yet behold, we are forcing our sons and our daughters to be slaves, and some of our daughters are forced into bondage already. And we are helpless because our fields and our vineyards belong to others.' Then I was very angry when I had heard their outcry and those words, and I consulted with myself and contended with the nobles and the rulers and said to them, 'You are exacting usury, each from his brother.' Therefore I held a great assembly against them, and I said to them, 'We, according to our ability, have redeemed our Jewish brothers who were sold to the nations. Now would you even sell your brothers that they may be sold to us?' Then they were silent and could not find a word to say. Again, I said, 'The thing which you are doing is not good. Should you not walk in the fear of our God because of the reproach of the nations, our enemies? And likewise, I, my brothers, and my servants are lending them money and grain. Please, let us leave off this usury. Please give back to them this very day their fields, their vineyards, their olive groves, and their houses. Also, the hundredth part of the money and of the grain and the new wine and the oil that you are exacting from them.' So during the building of the walls, there had been a great external threat," which we could read earlier on in the book, "and it was overcome by faith. However, now the threat is from within." Think about what's going on. Think about the abuse that is going on. As Nehemiah is trying to serve God and even serve his people, we have those who had been working on the wall, the building of the wall, left little time for making a living and none for farming. Therefore, they were forced to buy grain. However, little money buys little grain. The situation had required them to mortgage their property to borrow money. There were those who had continued farming, but they saw little demand for their crops. They were forced to borrow money to pay their taxes. Some have said that Persian property taxes could be as much as 40%. Some were so distressed in this time that they had to resort to some kind of indentured servitude in order to survive. So what do we see? We see that they, within their own Jewish community, were taking advantage of one another rather than helping one another. Look at chapter 5 and verse 7 again. He says, "I consulted with myself and contended with the nobles and the rulers and said to them, 'You are exacting usury, each from his brother.'" And get that emphasis, each from your own brother. This isn't a sacrificial life. They were taking advantage of one another. Go back up to chapter 5 and verse 1. This word outcry, there in chapter 5 and verse 1, there was this great outcry, it says, of the people and of their wives against their Jewish brothers. Interestingly, this is the same word that is used as the complaint of the Israelites under Egyptian oppression. You remember God had said, if you don't serve me, you're going to have enemies who are going to oppress you, and they're going to oppress your families. But now the oppression is coming from within. It's coming from their community. It's coming from their brethren. And there is this outcry. Rather than seeking opportunities to help and sacrificing on behalf of their brethren who had given themselves to improve the community as a whole, they're fleecing God's people. And with that background, it's in that section, if you go over to verse 19, Nehemiah is saying, remember me, O my God, for good according to all that I've done for the people. Nehemiah is outraged at this. Notice his response is not to take advantage of his own community, to take advantage of his own people, to see this as an opportunity to promote himself. As he prays this prayer, it's in the context of redeeming and helping and aiding and restoring his brethren. In fact, in verses 8 through 10 that we read, he rebukes them. He said, I was concerned about this, and he rebukes them. And then we read in verse 11, if you'll notice verse 11 again, he says, please give back to them their fields and their vineyards. Make restoration. He intercedes for the poor. He's a man of sacrifice, a sacrificial life. Only a sacrificial life prays to God, remember me for the good that I've been striving to do for this people. Can we pray that prayer? He exercised leadership there in verses 12 and 13. Leadership doesn't just sit back and say, you know, we have this horrible problem, and I know what the problem is, and I complain to everybody else about the problem, but I'm not doing anything proactively to help with the problem. In verse 12, then they said, notice the persuasion here, then they said, we will give it back and will require nothing from them. We will do exactly as you say. So I called the priest and I took an oath from them that they would do according to this promise. And I shook out the front of my garment and said, thus may God shake out every man from his house and from his possessions who does not fulfill this promise, etc. And they said, amen. He didn't just sit back. He was a man of sacrifice. Now I want you to see something else. Look at verses 14 through 19. If you're going to not just sit back and watch a problem, if you're going to be leading, you have to model what you profess is the right thing. You can't persuade people and lead people if you don't model the thing that you're telling them they ought to be doing. Now we all have shortcomings. But if you look at verse 14, look at what Nehemiah does. Look at Nehemiah's example. Why could he pray this prayer? He prayed this prayer because not only could he identify the problem, not only did he strive to persuade people to remedy the problem, but he actually modeled the spirit that he was trying to get them to have. And so in verse 14, moreover, from this day that I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, from the 20th year to the 32nd year of King Artaxerxes, for 12 years, neither I nor my kinsmen have eaten the governor's food allowance. But the former governors who were before me laid burdens on the people and took from them bread and wine, besides 40 shekels of silver. Even their servants domineered the people. But I, and we'll come back to this, I did not do so because of the fear of God. I also applied myself to the work on this wall. We did not buy any land, and all my servants were gathered there for the work. Moreover, there were at my table 150 Jews and officials, and besides those who came to us from the nations that were around us. And now that which was prepared for each day was one ox and six choice sheep. Also birds were prepared for me, etc. And then we come to at the end of verse 18, he says, yet for all of this, I did not demand the governor's food allowance, because the servitude was heavy on this people. Think about it. So he saw the problem, but he also had compassion on the people. He had a sacrificial mindset that all leads us into him praying, God, remember me. The reason he could pray that is because he had given his all to serving God by serving God's people. And that was the ultimate objective, and he did so for 12 years. I want you to look at verse 15. I think it's an important passage for us and for the application we want to offer. Can we pray this prayer, remember me, O my God? When you notice what's going on, look there at verse 15. Why did he do it? Why did he do it? How can he pray the prayer? Why did he do it? Verse 15, he says, remember me, O my God, in verse 19, for the good according to all that I've done for the people. But in verse 15, he says at the end of this verse, but I did not do so. So you go back up to verse 15. They had all these burdens upon the people. They were domineering among the people. He says, I didn't do that. I didn't act that way. I wasn't selfish. I did not do so because of the fear of God. Some translations render that as because of reverence for God. Now I want you to think about what he's saying. Why and how could he have this sacrificial mind and spirit because of his fear for God? He loved them because he loved God. You know, John in 1 John 4, isn't that what he says about loving one another? That love is of God, and if I don't love my brother, then how can I say I love God who I haven't seen when I don't love my brother whom I have seen? And he says, the reason I acted in this way was out of reverence for God. Barnabas, in Acts chapter 4, we see the compassion of the first century Christians. Why were they so selfless? Why were they so sacrificial? Why did they serve the way they did? Because ultimately their service is for God. And you're a child of God. And so you being a child of God, me being a child of God, we have that relationship because we both have a relationship with the Lord. And when we are unloving toward one another, when we are hostile toward one another, when we are divisive with each other, the problem's not just between each other. The problem is between each other and between our God and ourselves. Look at 2 Corinthians chapter 4. And notice what Paul said about the attitude he had as an apostle and that the apostles had toward brothers and sisters in Christ. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 15, he says, as he's encouraging them to be renewed in their heart and mind, he says, for all things are for your sakes. Well, in what context, Paul? He says, for all things are for your sake, so that the grace which is spreading to more and more people may cause the giving of thanks to abound to the glory of God. So we're working and we're doing all of this for you. Why are we doing all this for you? Yes, we love you, but where does that disposition come from? And who are we really serving? We're serving one another in the context of serving God. Let's think about shepherds for a minute. And the application to a shepherd. One of the qualifications of shepherds is that they not be self-willed. If a man is self-willed, the problem is not just that he's self-willed in his relationships with other people. He has a problem in his relationship with God. And you can't lead if you are a self-willed man because you have a problem and a critical problem in your relationship with God. And it will be devastating to those around you. Shepherds are described as those who serve as stewards of God, not as hirelings. Jesus describes the religious leadership of his day as being hirelings. They work for the pay. When the wolf comes, they run. They're concerned about themselves and enriching themselves. They're not concerned about the flock. Ezekiel chapter 34 is a very involved text in talking about the rulers of the Jews who were just enriching themselves and making themselves fat with their own resources, but they were not serving And when we come to the New Testament and we think about the work of shepherds, look at 1 Peter chapter 5. 1 Peter chapter 5. Notice this. Shepherds serve the flock, but ultimately they do so not only because they care about the flock, but because they have a respect for the chief shepherd, which is Christ. And when shepherds don't have a respect for the chief shepherd, they tend to strive to maintain a power of lordship over the flock rather than caring for the flock. What's the problem? Their relationship with God. 1 Peter chapter 5, therefore I exhort the elders among you as your fellow elder and witness of the sufferings of Christ and a partaker also of the glory that is to be revealed. Shepherd the flock of God among you, exercising oversight not under compulsion, but voluntarily according to the will of God. And not for sordid gain, but with eagerness, listen, nor yet as lording it over those allotted to your charge, but proving to be examples to the flock. It's God's flock. And you're a steward. Parents, we're striving to raise our children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. That's what we're striving to do. And our hope is that they will obey the gospel, but we must do our best to invest ourselves in doing what God has asked us to do. Our marriages, Ephesians 5 speaks of husbands loving their wives, and what is my, yes, we all fall short as husbands sometimes of this, but it is to emulate, it is to imitate Christ. And look at what he says to godly wives about the submission here, which is not anything tyrannical, but it is submission. It is loving submission and respect for her husband. But notice what he says there in Ephesians chapter 5 and in verse 22, I believe it is. Look at Ephesians 5 with me. I want you to notice this language here in Ephesians chapter 5. What is it that is driving this godly woman? What is it that day by day, what happens when, you know, she gets up one day and she doesn't like her husband that day? She loves him and she submits to him and she respects him. But what is the context of this? Look in Ephesians 5:22. Wives, be subject to your own husbands as to the Lord. It's not saying that you think your husband is Christ. It's saying you submit to your husband, but in doing so, in respecting him and strengthening him, in him being able to safely trust in you, your goal here is to glorify Christ, as unto Christ. You do this out of reverence and out of respect and out of love for Christ. And that puts a whole different context on this. You lead a sacrificial life. And we could go on. We could look at gospel preachers. 1 Corinthians chapter 3, Paul talks about this. That we preach the gospel to glorify God. And there will be some who respond. There will be some who reject. There will be some who are that gold and that silver and are refined by the trials of life. There are others that will be like hay and stubble, and they'll be burned up and will suffer loss. But God says through Isaiah, my word will not return unto me void. So what is my objective? My objective is to be faithful to God. And as I'm faithful to God, He grants the increase. Come to Nehemiah chapter 13. He was a life of sacrifice, but he also led a life of reverence for God. Again, notice verse 14 of chapter 13. We see it again. He prays, remember me for this, O my God, and do not blot out my loyal deeds which I have performed for the house of God and its services. For all that he had done Judah returns to sin. Chapter 13 and verses 4 through 10 speaks of this sin. Nehemiah's gone on the king's business for about 10 years, and during his absence, much of the work he had done to restore the people are undoing. So, you do all this work, and then it's undone in a pretty extreme way. As you read through Nehemiah, you read about a man by the name of Tobiah. He had been an oppressor. He had been one outside of the Jewish community who was persecuting the good work of God. And they have now gone so far as to move Tobiah, an enemy of Judah, into the storeroom. Think about this. This is shocking. Into the storeroom of the temple, allowing him to now gain influence in the Jewish community. Look at chapter 13 and in verse 5. Well, verse 4 says, "Now prior to this, Eliashib, the priest, who was appointed over the chambers of the house of our God, being related to Tobiah, had prepared a large room for him where formerly they put the grain offerings and the frankincense and the utensils and the tithes of grain and wine and oil prescribed for the Levites, the singers and the gatekeepers and the contributions for the priests." That's their service to God. The resources and the things for their service to God went in this room. And what they've done now is they've taken the enemy of God and he is living in the room where the resources for their worship to God belonged. And as you look at verses 10 through 12, the problem with the tithes not being given and the Levites were out working in the fields. What led to that? Irreverence. How do you justify that? I'd like to be sitting in that business meeting. Well, how do you justify that? You justify that because you have an irreverent heart toward God. And you know, once you get to that place, you can justify anything in your mind. You can justify anything. But let's see how Nehemiah responds and how we should respond. We have this return to sin, but Nehemiah zealously, and you know, this description here in Nehemiah chapter 13 sounds so much like Jesus when he has the money changers. It's very similar. I mean, he has a whip and he runs them out of there. And here is Nehemiah. Nehemiah has a zeal for the Lord's worship. And it was rooted in his reverence for God. So on one hand, he's very sacrificial. And he gives himself and he's concerned about his people. And I want you to see the balance in this. But then we read this prayer again in a context where he's saying, "Lord, remember me. Don't blot out. Don't forget about my loyal deeds. I did this out of loyalty and faithfulness to you that I have performed for the house of my God and its services." In fact, we read that Nehemiah was righteously angry, that he was grieved bitterly, that this was very displeasing to him. Would it have bothered us, though? Congregations have done similar things. They've prostituted themselves spiritually. They have compromised. Whole families have compromised. But what did Nehemiah do? Look at chapter 13 and verse 8. He throws all of Tobiah's household goods out of the room. He cleanses the rooms, 13:9 says, and restored them to their proper order. He brings the Levites back and restores the tithe and ensured that someone that was reliable and trustworthy was watching over this important service. What do we learn from this? The pursuit of God's holiness and God's grace involves accountability and responsibility. This is not a free-for-all. And we don't get to do things outside of a context that is pleasing to God and feel justified in doing so. And we could look at 1 Corinthians 5, the church at Corinth and the need for discipline there, with a man who was living with his father's wife, and the need to cleanse God's people. Again, an irreverent action comes from an irreverent heart. And let me say this. Maybe there'll be another time where I can say more. But, brother, and it's getting harder and harder, and it is imperative that we as parents take this to heart. Our society not only has become irreverent, they have become hostile in certain ways to service to God. But then there is another problem, and the other problem is just this so casual. It's just such a very casual approach to God. And I think it is important that in how we carry ourselves and how we view worship, even how we dress when we come to worship, how we behave ourselves, that we are impressing upon our children and our grandchildren the need to reverence God. When we are engaged in prayer, when we are engaged in serving on the Lord's table, these are important activities. This is the worship of God. And I will tell you, I have never known of a congregation that became hyper-casual in those ways that didn't become casual in other ways. When my attitude about worship, I don't come to this with reverence in my spirit, in my attitude, where emphasis isn't put on this in my family as I teach my children and raise them in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, that will in the long run be devastating to my family and to God's people. And then our final point, look there in chapter 13. Notice verse 22, he says this. And then again in verse 31, we see a life of concern for God's people. Verse 22, "And I commanded the Levites that they should purify themselves and come as gatekeepers to sanctify the Sabbath day. For this also remember me, O my God, and have compassion on me according to the greatness of your loving kindness." So Nehemiah knows he needs compassion and he needs mercy. But he says, "Remember me for this effort that I had concern for your people because I love you." Verse 31, "And I arranged for the supply of the wood at the appointed times and for the first fruits. Remember me, O my God, for good." If you look at chapter 13, verses 15 through 21, there was a concern over the failure to honor the Sabbath and under that first covenant that had reference to their relationship with God. And this goes to my point about worship. The people were treating it like it was any other day in verse 15. There were pervasive influences from without which were encouraging them not to reverence it, much like our culture has encouraged us not to reverence the things that need to be reverenced. And their whole church is willing to give in to all of that, which is destructive. There was a failure in the leadership. Look at verse 17, which allowed this to continue. He says, "Then I reprimanded the nobles of Judah and said to them, 'What is this evil thing that you're doing by profaning the Sabbath day?'" He had a concern, look at verse 23, "for the loss of their distinctiveness. In those days, I also saw that the Jews had married women from Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab, and as for their children, half spoken the language of Ashdod, and none of them was able to speak the language of Judah, but the language of his own people. So I contended with them, and I cursed them, and struck them, and pulled them out by the hair, and made them swear by God, 'You shall not give your daughters to their sons, and take their daughters for your sons and for yourselves. Did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin regarding these things, yet among the many nations there was no king like him, and he was loved by his God, and God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, the foreign women caused him to sin. Do we then hear about you that you have committed all that great evil by acting unfaithfully against our God? And I want you to see something. Look at verse 29. He says, remember them, and then later he says, remember me. Remember them, God, because of their unfaithfulness and the rebellion against you. But remember me that I've given my heart to service to you. He was concerned, and this is the point of application that I want you to see about the need for distinctiveness. And the fact was they had lost their memory of their religious foundation and their root system. And when that happens, we will fall away. But it doesn't have to happen. Nehemiah wanted to rebuild and he wanted to restore and he wanted to see God's people purified. And so as we end this morning and we've thought about this consistent prayer, this is what I would offer to us. When you think about Nehemiah and you think about that prayer, what we see from Nehemiah is a life of sacrifice for God. We see a life of reverence for the Lord. We see a life of concern for the people of God. And I will tell you, if at the end of the way, and you're nearing the end of your life, and you're breathing your last breath, when your life has been characterized the way Nehemiah's has been, as a life of sacrifice for God and a life of reverence for God and a life of concern for the people of God, that is a life well lived. Is that the life that you have begun to lead? That is God's will. What is our objective? No matter what happens, we can talk about the details. It is to be faithful to God because we love Him. If you're not a Christian, we invite you. Will you come into the kingdom of God today through obedience to the gospel? Come now as together we stand and we sing.